This podcast was recorded on the date indicated with the link. The views and opinions expressed herein are as of the date recorded and should not be construed as an offer to buy or sell any securities. Such views and opinions may differ from those of DoubleLine Capital or its affiliates and are subject to change without notice. DoubleLine has no obligation to provide updates or changes. Welcome to Monday Morning Minutes, hosted by DoubleLine's fixed income asset allocation strategists and portfolio managers, Samuel Lau and Jeffrey Mayberry. Please direct any comments and suggestions to minutes@doubleline.com or see us on Twitter at DLineMinutes.
Welcome to this week's episode of DoubleLine Monday Morning Minutes. I'm Jeff Mayberry, along with Sam Lau.
Hey, hey.
Sam, recording just after the close on Friday, August 6th. It felt like it was going to be a week of summer doldrums, a nice slow week. I don't know about you, but then my Twitter feeds blew up yesterday when it turns out that that Messi isn't going to be re-signing with Barcelona, and it's going to go to PSG or Manchester City. I know our guy, Jacobo, is a little hurt about it. I just want to tell him that it's going to be okay, and everything will work out in the end.
I thought you were going to say your Twitter feed blew up on our D-line minutes handle, but I'll accept that.
When we had American football tweets, or people who focus on American football start tweeting about Barcelona and Messi, it's a big deal.
Yeah.
But I guess that was my excitement for the week. But maybe there's a little bit of excitement I missed in markets. Why don't you hit us off there, and we'll see if there was anything too exciting there.
Sounds good. And for loyal listeners here, they'll notice that we're going to add a new kind of line item here to discuss when we go over our markets. And this really came up across on the back of a request that we received from one of our listeners here. His name's Mark, and we thought we'd try it out because the number of the requests that he submitted were quite reasonable. He dropped a little bit of hate on Mr. Mayberry here, saying that he needed a better mic. So hopefully that's been cured, Mark, but you can feel free to let us know if Mr. Mayberry's sound quality still sucks. Mark also asked for a chart of the week or something that we could focus on each week. And one thing that we wanted to say there is we do offer a series of charts that Jason Ferrent posts to our Twitter each week based on the topics that Mayberry and I hit each week. So for charts of the week, which are a little bit more difficult to focus on during the actual podcast, given that it's audio, we do have accompanying charts based on the topics that we do address. So be sure you can check that out on our Twitter, the Twitter homepage, D-Line Minutes.
And if you remember when we were talking about curve flatteners and curve steepeners, we're having trouble, talking about it without moving our hands around. So I don't think you want us discussing a charts, in a verbal sense, without having the visual aid there. So yeah, definitely our D-Line Minutes is the place to check it out. Check those out.
Yeah, and perhaps that's because of our communication skills are too weak there to be able to fully paint a nice picture there. But we do suggest you to check out our Twitter homepage there. So, and then finally, one of the suggestions they had was about adding Bitcoin to our market recap. And Jeff and I actually struggled with this for a little while, debating whether or not we should include it. And then finally, at the end of the discussion, we thought we'd give it a shot. Why not? Especially on the back of some of it seems like some of the progression that Bitcoin is making as part of a way to invest in it and on the regulated exchange. The SEC chairman, Gensler, this week came out and made some comments that some took as kind of a signal as perhaps paving the way for future Bitcoin ETFs, and that prompted a number of money managers to quickly register plans for planned new ETFs with the SEC this week. And there does seem that there are other mutual funds out there already. I'm not sure what quite the difference is between the mutual fund format for and the ETF when it comes to the Bitcoin and being able to actually launch a mutual fund already, whereas the ETFs are kind of in the holding pattern. But either way, we thought it might be a good time to start that there. So thanks for the suggestions there, Marks. And just one other thing too, is we did see your question as well. So you can expect that an answer on that or attempt at an answer on that in the forthcoming episode. But with that, let's jump into the markets. It was a mixed bag across asset classes this week. The S&P 500 leading the way. It was up 1 point, up a percentage point week to date. And financials were the leaders there, up looks like just over 3.5% higher on the week to date. Staples, consumer staples, was the lone negative performer here, down just about 70 basis points or so. When we shift over to fixed income, the 10-year treasury looks like it closed on the highs of the week. It closed with a firm 1.3% yield on the 10-year treasury, no round needed. And that's on the highs of the week. It had gone as low as, looks like, about 112 basis points that it hit on Wednesday. So it basis points higher on close this week than last week. Commensurate with that move, the Barclays US bond aggregate was down 50 basis points on the back of that treasury move. Each component was down commensurate with duration, it looks like. So when we look across the screen there, all three components were in the red. Even some of the non so some of the high yield or the high below investment grade, sorry, I'm stumbling here, below investment grade corporate credit sectors that aren't in the index also ended the week in the red there. So moving on to commodities, the BCOM, which is the Bloomberg Commodity Index, closed the week down just under 2%. And that was led by a broad decline, looks like, across the energy complex. WTI crude oil jumps out here. It had it was down just about 8% this week, dipping below the $70 handle on per barrel of crude to close the week at just over $68 a barrel. So this is likely a result of fears that market participants are having right now based on assessing the impact of the Delta variant on the early stages of this economic recovery, as we saw a return of a number of COVID-related restrictions, not only here in the U.S., but across the world. And one area to kind of focus on when it comes to the sensitivity to the commodity, or how commodities are sensitive to, is China. And China has done quite a bit of in the ways of restrictions to limit mobility there. So that's one to watch out for in the coming days and weeks there.
I think oil's been kind of bouncing around. It's kind of bounced off of this, kind of close to this level the past couple of times. And so it'll be interesting to see whether, we're down a buck a barrel today. So whether it bounces off that, come Monday or if it continues this downward trend or kind of slows around, but it's bounced off this level a few times.
And speaking of bouncing off levels, and one thing that we haven't talked about in a little while was gold. I see that gold closed below the 1800 mark, dropped about 40 bucks today alone. So versus last week, it's down about 50 bucks. So most of that move was today, but it just closed here just shy of $1,760 per troy ounce of gold there. So
I guess that's what happens when we let our gold bug take vacation for a day. It plummets.
That's right. So we can blame him for that and no more vacations for him. Or we can blame the jobs data that came out today. But we'll talk a little bit more about that and perhaps having an impact on gold when we hit the macro section. And then finally, the newcomer to the scoreboard here is Bitcoin. Bitcoin is up 6% on the week. I don't know if you want to call that pretty much flat for Bitcoin, but 6% is kind of a few tick move for Bitcoin there. So not too much of a move for the original digital currency. But right now on the screen, I'm looking at, let's see here. Actually, let me just pull this up here. Bitcoin is at just shy of $43,000 per coin there. So year to date, it looks like it's up nearly 50%. And to give a sense kind of the swings and the volatility that we've just seen in this year alone in terms of how the how Bitcoin has traded. It started out the year at $30,000, just around there, and then it doubled that by March before when it reached 60,000, and then it topped out in April at 65,000, and then it made its way back down to 30,000 the following month. So it just kind of gives you that picture that crypto really isn't for the faint of heart. It kind of brings to mind that the Wall Street quote too, right? That crypto, kind of like money, never sleeps, because you can trade it 24 hours a day, 365 days a year, if you're looking at the actual spot, or I don't know if they call it the physical market, but the actual coin itself. So one thing we should note here is that the way we're going to report this performance in terms of just when we talk about the percentage changes here, it's going to be using Bloomberg's pricing convention, which gives Bitcoin a 1 minute nap, if you will, each day at 1:59 p.m. Pacific time, before it starts out the new measurable period at 2 p.m. So that's going to be the break for which we talk about performance here in an otherwise 24-hour a day tradable asset.
And who knows where Bitcoin could be a Monday morning when people listen to this. It could be 30,000, it could be 60,000, or I guess most likely somewhere in between. But with that volatility over the weekend, certainly isn't something that people, for those, it's better for maybe some the day traders as opposed to the Rip Van Winkle type traders.
Yeah, you know what? We can just call it here. Let's just see if we think that Bitcoin will break out above 43,000 by the time we end this podcast, Jeff. But right. it seems like it has some legs on it right now. But since we're novices in the space, we'll just keep it at that. But I do remember when I first started working in commodities with Jeff Sherman, our deputy CIO here at DoubleLine, and he told me to strap in. He said strap in, because I was just coming over from the fixed income world, and he said that commodity vol is like a roller coaster. So, when you compare that to even, fixed income, but even equities, even that truly was the case. But, I don't really know what the appropriate analogy is here for us as we start delving into this crypto space and talking about the markets there. But a roller coaster seemed a little tame, compared to that. So maybe bungee jumping or something like that.
Or a rocket ship.
Yeah. Rocket ship that doesn't just go in that straight line, right? To the moon kind of thing. So we'll see. It definitely has that acceleration, though.
Well, one thing that you said earlier, when we were talking earlier, that sold me about talking about Bitcoin, or just kind of including it in our markets wrap up, was just that it's a good risk indicator. So when people get out of risk, they'll get out of Bitcoin, and people, when they're bullish, they'll get into Bitcoin. And I think that is another good indicator to use. And so that's kind of how you sold. I don't want to say you sold me on it, but when you brought that point up again, then I think that kind of cemented the fact that maybe we should include it in our market wrap up.
Yeah, and risk and perhaps euphoria as well, right? So whatever the opposite of euphoria is there. So I guess we could use it as a barometer of one of those things there. But we'll give it a shot. Let's see where it takes us.
I'm sure our Twitter people will like that, and we'll be able to post some more charts on Bitcoin now.
All right. With that in mind, why don't you kick us off on the macro part of the podcast
then? Yeah, it's going to feel very, very tame now, the macro side of things. On Monday, we did get ISM manufacturing for July. That number fell to below 60 with a 59.5 print. It was expected to come in at 61, so a bit of a disappointment there. Kind of reading into the underlying quotes in the release, they say that demand remains strong as orders are stacking up and inventories are being depleted. So it's kind of more of the same stories, but also bodes well for the manufacturing side, as they will need to continue manufacturing to get those inventories back up to previous levels. On Wednesday, we got ISM services PMI. It was expected to be 60.5, came in well above that at a 64.1 number. As our gold bug put it in his write-up that he sent to us, Mark Kimbrough, he said it was a change in the somber tone as this one was a bullish indicator, and that it was a very good strong report as you could see from the 64.1 number. And then on Thursday we got the jobless numbers. They kind of held steady overall. The total persons claiming unemployment got below 13 million, or remains below 13 million. We had the July 4th holiday number that was below 13 million, but this is the first kind of non-holiday number we've had below 13 million. So that number continues to decrease at a relatively slow pace, but at least it's heading in the right direction. And then finally today, the big news of the week was the payroll Friday. Non-farm payrolls came in well above expectations at 943,000. Expectations were 870. I did see some estimates that were like 1.1 or 1.15 type million numbers. So we're a little bit below that. But then if you kind of include the previous month was revised higher to 938,000 from 850. To put them all together, you get about a 1.1 million total revision plus payroll gain today. Most of those gains came from the leisure and hospitality sectors. So that's a good sign as people are getting back out there. And I guess that's also indicative of the services side of things. And that with that ISM number, the unemployment rate. So the U3 unemployment rate fell to 5.4 from 5.9. So a big drop there. Was expected to only drop by 0.2 to 5.7, but dropping 0.5% there. And the underemployment, which is what Chair Powell has indicated might be his indicator for employment or for maximum employment, that fell also from 9.8 to 9.2. So we're getting to a place where it's we're starting to see some pretty steady healing of the labor market. Does this mean that we're going to hear some more talk about tapering and whether this is enough? I don't think this is enough to say that the job market has made, you know, quote, substantial further progress, unquote. But I think we're in the place where we're on the right track for substantial further progress, and interesting to see whether Jackson Hole, whether Chair Powell talks about tapering or whether it's put off until the September FOMC meeting. And Jackson Hole, remind me, Sam, is when is it? It's end of this month, but what days?
Yeah, it's the August 26th through 28th. And if I recall correctly, the 28th is a Saturday, which kind of, you know, might set it up for, as some people might call it, a boondoggle, you know, if nothing interesting comes out of here. So Jackson Hole in the summer, I'm sure it's kind of nice. So it'd be a nice little way to end their little conference shindig there.
I'm surprised they don't make it kind of the first week in September and make it a nice long weekend with Labor Day. But I guess that's too obvious to be a boondoggle. I guess you have the two weekends in a row.
Yeah, I was going to say that might be a little bit too transparent there, but we'll check to see how the substantial further progress goalpost, see if it does feel to be since we're talking about transparency, it does seem to be such a moving target there, just given the ambiguity around the what could be considered substantial further progress. But, you know, just digging through the numbers on the unemployment front, it's hard to say anything, but it was just a very solid positive print here this month. You know, looking at the number of people that went into the employed category, there was over a million people that just were newly put into that category. So that's definitely strong. And from that, the way that came about was that there's roughly 800,000 people shifting from unemployed, it seems like, and going into that unemployed or into that employed status. So definitely positive all around. And we saw an increase in the labor force as well, with about 300,000 people going back into the labor force on a net basis. So overall, just very strong numbers. It's hard to not be excited about that, but we'll just see if it can continue.
And it seems like that was the big catalyst for the whopping 8 basis point move up in 10-year treasury rates today. So
yeah.
And as you were talking about, that's a big move in bonds.
Yeah.
8 basis points. And then we're talking oil was down 8% on the week. So
yeah, especially given this low, you know, the low base of yields that they moved up from. So that, and don't forget that drop in gold prices as well. So, you know, if we're going to try to rationalize short-term movements here. I think this is the best we've got right there with the jobs data on these one-day moves that we've seen. But with that, let's jump into the question of the week here, and really becomes a topic of the week that you and I decided to put on this podcast, because one of the things that people are going to start hearing more and more about is the debt ceiling. You're going to start seeing it in the news if you haven't already seen it already. So we thought that we'd give our listeners a little background, you know, and ways to think about it. We'll give you a definition, talk about what it is, go through some of the history, and then close it off with why it matters today. So, Jeff, do you want to kick us off on that?
Yeah, sounds good, Sam. We'll go back in history until 1917. So a little over 100 years ago, Congress typically authorized borrowing for specific purposes. So say, you know, the example I saw was say we're going to build the Panama Canal. Congress says, okay, we're going to authorize spending for it. And then you go from there. In World War One, I think because the spending got so high, you didn't really know what it was going to be spent on specifically. Congress set like an aggregate limit to the amount that allowed the Treasury to kind of structure that debt. And they kind of finalized the idea of a single debt ceiling. So overall debt ceiling in the late 1930s. And that kind of allowed it to progress to where it is today. But it allowed the Treasury to issue debt up to that debt ceiling. And once you hit that limit, you couldn't have any additional spending, no more issuing of debt until a new limit was established. And this was back in the day where, you know, it was very, very low numbers, let's say. Over the past 60 or so years, so since the early 1960s, the debt limit has been adjusted 78 times. So, you know, 78 over 60, way more than one time a year on average does it get adjusted. And the adjustments come in, you know, sometimes they permanently raise it. Sometimes they temporarily extend the debt limit. Or like the Fed likes to do, you come across a limit, then you just redefine what it means. So those were the three options that Congress has used over the past 60 years. But since over the past 10 years, so since 2011, instead of setting an absolute limit, Congress has come across a new way of doing it where they would just say, we suspend the debt ceiling for a certain period of time, and that time is to be determined in the bill. And then at the end of this period of time, the debt ceiling is set at that current level. And so then when you hit that current level, either the Congress has to re-raise the limit or suspend it again. So why we're talking about it now is back in July 2019, Congress voted to suspend the debt limit until July 31st of 2021, which was this past Sunday. After July 2021, the prior limit, which was $22 trillion, would be reset to include any new borrowings over those subsequent 2 years. And so on the 31st, the Sunday, the limit was reinstated at $28.5 trillion. So we went from 22 to 28.5 in 2 years.
It's just such an amazing mechanism that Congress put in place. It's a self-adjusting debt ceiling, right? So you don't even have to argue about the next time around. All you have to do is just hope that you can maintain a level below that kind of the expiry date, right? After you accumulate the additional debt over the prior debt limit. So it's amazing. Yeah, it's amazing.
It is
struggling,
yes,
now with a $28.5 trillion debt ceiling.
Well, to put that into context, so it rose by $6 trillion over these past 2 years. Prior to this move, the most the debt limit had ever risen in one kind of suspension of the debt ceiling was $2.1 trillion in August of 2011. So three times the previous high was this time. Now, certainly, a lot of the pandemic spending was built into that. So it probably wouldn't have been $6 trillion or $6.5 trillion without the coronavirus pandemic, but still shows you how much has been spent and how high that limit is now. And but there's nothing to be worried about yet, right? So right now, because we're at the 28.5, it's kind of referred to as a soft ceiling, since the Treasury can do some extraordinary measures, such as suspending reinvestments into retirement funds for civil servants and postal workers. And you know, they resort to these extraordinary measures pretty frequently. Apparently, they've had to do it several times in the past 10 years, including three times while Trump was president. So it's not a I guess when you do it three times in 4 years, and now we're doing it again, so four times in 5 years, is that really an extraordinary measure if it happens, that frequently? I guess it depends on how you define that, but really, I think that you have this soft cap, and really, what happens is you get to a hard cap, and when does that happen? And the CBO or the Congressional Budget Office estimates that the Treasury could stretch out these extraordinary measures, could stretch out the existing cash they have until October or November. So really, we have a couple months here until we get to really a much harder ceiling, a much harder limit. And after that, after we kind of hit this hard limit, that's really when things come down. And really what happens is the Treasury has to, what I was reading is the Treasury has kind of two options. One is they can prioritize payments. So you've got to pay your coupons payments on your U.S. Treasury debt, because you certainly don't want to default on those. Or you can furlough federal workers and contractors. And so I believe the last time this happened, the Treasury said that they don't have the mechanisms in place to prioritize payments. So they got to pay everyone at the same time, which maybe they've worked on that subsequent to that time period. But they did rely on furloughing workers. And I think the last time that there was a shutdown, it lasted a little bit over a month. So a lot of the workers were, I believe that if you remember, Sam, some people were working without getting paid. Some people were not working. I believe there was like an IRS backlog in terms of processing tax returns because those workers were furloughed. And so there was a big backlog there. But really, that's kind of the measures that they take once you hit that hard limit.
Yeah. And I do remember that. And that's one of the things where, just imagine you're not getting paid, but so if you're on furlough, I guess that's bad enough because you probably do want that paycheck and you're willing to work. But imagine not getting a paycheck, but still having to show up to work. I mean, that's just like a kick to the face. But then imagine the fact that I think, and I'm pretty certain about this, that politicians, those in the House and the Senate still get paid during that period of time. But I remember back in one of those episodes that a few of the senators decided to forego their paychecks, as they said, in solidarity with those furloughed employees that were not getting paid at all. And there's a handful of them relative to the entire number that are employed between the House and the Senate, or, I don't know if employed is the right word, but so they still get paid while they're out there negotiating and haggling over the terms there. So that's always fun.
That's right. And this past week, Janet Yellen came out and said, quote, "I respectfully urge Congress to protect the full faith and credit of the United States by acting as soon as possible," end quote. And it's kind of funny because she says this now as the Treasury Secretary, and back in 2011, she was the Vice Chair of the Federal Reserve. And back then she said the debt limit, quote, "usually turns out to be just theater," unquote. So, it's funny when you're on the other side of things, it's like, no, we got to act now. We got to get this taken care of. But when you're, in the Federal Reserve outside of it, you're just like, oh, it's just theater. But, back in 2011 was the time when President Obama and congressional Republicans brought the country down to the wire. They used extraordinary measures. They, narrowly avoided a default. And this is the time when the S&P Standard & Poor's downgraded the U.S. from AAA to AA+. I remember this was a big news at the time, but to us, it seemed like it was, the U.S. is always can pay their debts. They just need to, they can just raise taxes to pay their debts. So really downgrading it from AAA to AA+, I guess, was just an indicator of the political grandstanding that goes on, and that there's always a possibility of some sort of slip up where they actually have to technically default on their treasuries. But I guess if that's going to happen, maybe they've prioritized payments, and so the Treasury can default on the ones that the Fed owns. That would be what I would do. Default on the ones the Fed owns. All the ones that are not Fed owned, we can keep making those coupon payments.
Yeah, and don't forget, you can default on the intragovernmental holdings too, which are the it goes back to Social Security benefits and whatever excess they have there, they have to, in terms of cash, they have to invest in treasury. So that's what's referred to as intergovernmental holdings, I believe. But it's not held by the public, let's say. So I suppose they could default on that. But, you know, as you bring back the 2011 experience, I do recall after that downgrade that risk markets broadly sold off. But the bond market, the U.S. Treasuries actually rallied during that period of time. So by S&P downgrading it based on the potential for default on those treasuries, they actually rallied as, you know, risk sentiment was really off during that time, and the flight to relative safety, I suppose, within that context became the trade.
Right. But it's always interesting when that kind of things happens where people think, oh wait, we got downgraded, so the probability of default's higher, but that means things are riskier, so I'm gonna buy treasuries, even though that's where the probability of default actually went up.
That's right. So, and then just to throw a little bit more into context here, Fitch, another main credit rating agency there, did issue a negative outlook on the U.S. Long-term credit rating as well. It didn't downgrade it, but it did issue a negative forecast for that. And this was back in the middle of July, and that was based largely due to the trajectory of the U.S. federal debt level in absolute terms, but also as just the debt to GDP ratio there. So along with that note, Fitch wrote that they view that the failure to raise or suspend the debt limit is meaningful, but it is a remote risk. So that kind of comes back to perhaps Yellen's comment back in, 2011, when she said it was theater, but it is political theater for sure.
Yeah, and typically these things go until like the last minute, as in this case, the Republicans will try to get as much as they can out of the Democrats. That's just what's happened in this case. Certainly, it's been the other way around many times before. But there's really no point in trying to really negotiate and trying to get anything wrapped up until the last minute, as negotiations tend to do. I guess on a more immediate basis is that because they're at the debt limit, the T-bill issuance will likely to be more constrained than before, because you can't really issue any more debt. So some people are thinking that that's actually going to increase your reserve repo numbers that our listener Jordan likes to look at all the time, those reverse repo numbers. So those numbers could increase as there's less T-bills out there. But we're not anywhere close to like a cap there on the reverse repo side of things. So it shouldn't be too much of a market moving event until we get closer and closer to that October or November timeframe. And certainly as we get closer to October or November, the CBO will likely kind of narrow that range from a large 2-month range to maybe a week or so in terms of when we can expect Congress to really get their act together and get something done.
Yeah, and that just brings to mind, too, that Yellen fairly recently, I want to say in the last week or two, indicated that, contrary to the CBO projections of September or October, that that X date, as they call it, could come as soon as mid to late August. So, definitely on this side of the table, she's looking to get things resolved as quickly as possible. But I hope she realizes, too, that Congress is either about to or is already taking their August recess, their summer break here. So, I don't think they see it as that urgent as well. So,
they're going to be, I think I saw that they're going to be voting tomorrow on the infrastructure bill in the Senate. So that's going to be more spending, certainly that's going to come after the debt ceiling.
Yeah. So it sounds like all in all, the verdict is it perhaps is much ado about nothing, because ultimately the choices are to raise the debt limit or suspend the debt limit, which is probably the more likely scenario, is to suspend the debt limit again for a period of time, rather than the alternative, which is to default on your debt. So that's why I think a lot of times it does become a bit of a yawner when we start discussing the debt ceiling, because we kind of imagine that it's going to be a non-event. Otherwise, there's going to be significant downside.
I guess the downside is that we have to see sensational headlines and political talk for the next couple of months.
Yeah, that's always
when we know it's going to be pushed out till the last minute.
Yeah. Yep. That's right. So, well, thanks for that, Jeff. Thanks for taking on the topic of the week for us. I'll push us into the things to keep an eye on next week. And on Monday, we've got the Jolt's job openings, and that's expected to be 9.2 million job openings, which are pretty much unchanged from the prior month. So, when we're talking about it, you know, there's a lot of talk about perhaps there's more demand and people don't want to actually take on those jobs for various reasons. But you know, back in 2019, I think you pulled up that the average around that time was around 7.2 million job openings pre-pandemic. So if you look at it in the context of that versus where we are today, it means, you know, maybe about 2 million more jobs is the differential, and that's how much we have to go. But then also one thing that we've been pointing out that has to be kept in mind is just, you know, the differential in payroll numbers prior, or the number of people in the labor force also prior to the pandemic is lower, but we also have to try to account for the people that might have taken early retirement, just said, you know, with this round of the pandemic, you know, we may just go into retirement a little bit earlier than we had planned, you know, before. So there may be a contingency of that population that's not coming back to the workforce going forward. So it is something that continues to be monitored by the folks here at Double Line, and we'll see how that progresses. And then on Wednesday, we've got Wednesday and Thursday, we've got the inflation prints there. So Wednesday just kicks it off with CPI, with the month over month inflation expected to be down 50 basis points down from previous month. And then we're looking at CPI down to 5.3% on the headline year-over-year number and 4.3% core year-over-year. And then on Thursday, as I mentioned, PPI comes in. That's the producer price index. And those that's expected to be down also from the prior month. And the month-over-month expectation is for it to be a plus 0.6% month over month. And that would bring the year over year down to 7.1% on the headline, down from 7.3%. So while still high, especially relative to historical average prints on both inflation measures, they are expected to slow down in terms of the year over year rate over the previous month.
Yeah, and I think we expect maybe the last month we get a five handle on headline CPI. Maybe we drop to a four handle, especially, I mean, as you and I were talking earlier, especially given oil down 8% kind of since the beginning of the month, that we really could see the headline number drop kind of commensurate with that drop in oil.
That's right. And then I think that energy component of which oil is in is right around 7% of headline CPI. So it is a pretty good pretty good contributor to the overall basket as well.
So I would expect that people will start looking more at core CPI again, as opposed to the headline number, is kind of get a feel for how kind of inflation is going to be moving along.
Yeah. And that's all on the backdrop of what we've been talking about for quite some time now, is, you know, while some of these components like energy is expected to be a little bit lower and perhaps be a drag to CPI, both headline and core. But, you know, we've long said that the OER, the owner's equivalent rent component in CPI, is the one to watch for, and that's far stickier, and that is lagged. Owner's equivalent rent is lagged to some of the headlines that we've been seeing in the housing front, where home prices are up, you know, high teens percentage. I think it was 16 or 17% year over year on the Shiller index recently.
That's right. So that's really going to be, you know, whether they, I guess that's kind of why the Fed is trying to stick with the transitory, or you kind of use that framing for inflation, whether home prices are, how much they go in, and whether there's kind of deflation and other components of CPI that kind of are going to offset that housing inflation.
Yep.
Well, I think that about wraps it up, Sam. I'd like to thank everyone for tuning in again this week.
Yeah, thanks everyone for listening to us and continuing to listen to us. It's a special thanks to Mark for a couple of suggestions that he sent in that we found useful. So Monday Morning Minutes, don't forget to subscribe to us so you don't miss an episode. You can pick us up each Monday before the bell. on your favorite podcast source there. So we're available on the iTunes, SoundCloud, Stitcher, Spotify, and Google Podcasts. And don't forget to hit us up on the Twitter at D-Line Minutes. You can send us questions, suggestions, comments there, or you can do it via email at minutes@doubleline.com.
Yeah, and you can find more information about DoubleLine at our website, doubleline.com. And don't forget to subscribe to our YouTube channel at youtube.com/doubleline capital. We did post the latest edition of the DoubleLine Roundtable on commodities, so I hope everyone checked that out or is in the midst of checking it out. Don't forget to subscribe to Sam's other podcast, The Sherman Show. You can follow him and Jeff Sherman on Twitter at Sherman Show Pod. I'd like to point out Bitcoin 42,794. So did not make that 43,000 by the end of the podcast today, Sam. So maybe next week.
Yeah, it didn't seem to have much movement at all while we were talking here. So we probably lulled it to sleep there. Because the crypto whisperers, right? So, but thanks everyone for tuning in, and good luck out there.
The audio presentation represents DoubleLine's intellectual property. No portion of this presentation may be published, reproduced, transmitted, or rebroadcast in any media in any form without express written permission of DoubleLine. DoubleLine has no obligation to provide any updates or changes. To receive permission from DoubleLine, please contact media@doubleline.com. Neither DoubleLine nor any of its affiliates makes any representation or warranty as to the accuracy or completeness of the statements or any information contained in this podcast and any liability therefor, including in respect of direct, indirect, or consequential loss or damage, is expressly disclaimed. DoubleLine is not providing any financial, economic, legal, accounting, or tax advice in this podcast. The receipt of this podcast by any listener is not to be taken as constituting the giving of investment advice by any DoubleLine entity or individual to that listener, nor to constitute such person a client of any DoubleLine entity. The portfolio risk management process includes an effort to monitor and manage risk, but does not imply low risk.
Copyright 2021 DoubleLine Capital.